Welcome to ClinPharm Pod. I'm Elena Webster, Deputy Managing Editor for the ASCPT family of journals. My guest today is Dr. Avery McIntosh, Director at Pfizer and Associate Editor for Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics. Avery, thanks so much for joining me.
Great to be with you, Elena.
CPT has just issued a new call for papers for a themed issue on quantitative clinical pharmacology for evidence generation and next generation drug development, which is helpfully subtitled, because that's a mouthful, turning data, models, and mechanisms into decisions. Avery, why did CPT choose to focus on this theme now, and what's driving the need to turn diverse evidence into concrete decisions like dose selection or benefit risk assessment?
Yeah, that's a long call for papers title. So I'll try to start at the beginning, because this really grew out of a lot of conversations among the associate editor group. So when I was first asked to come on to clinical pharmacology and therapeutics, it was as the chief statistical consultant, which was an honor for me because I'd been a longtime reader of CPT. And after a few months of that, our editor-in-chief asked me to also become an associate editor. And we immediately started to discuss the intersection of my chosen discipline, statistics, with some of the core disciplines covered in CPT journal. So the clinical pharmacology, obviously, pharmacometrics, quantitative systems pharmacology, and regulatory science, and how my field, statistics, is sort of under the hood in a lot of these disciplines, or maybe in the background. But these groups don't always communicate, I think, as much as they could. They're sometimes siloed. And at the same time, the field of clinical pharmacology itself is really changing pretty quickly. There's new regulatory guidances and emerging methodologies and technologies. And so we wanted to discuss some of these recent guidances and how we, as practitioners, as drug developers, work together across our respective disciplines in a quantitative way to generate evidence and hopefully make impactful decisions. So in sum, the goal is really to show the intersection of these domains and showcase some of the cutting edge of the field and how we really work together to generate evidence.
Thank you. So the call covers a lot of ground, from model-informed drug development and innovative trial designs to real-world evidence, AI, ML, digital health technologies, and advanced therapeutics like cell and gene therapies. Are there one or two areas you're personally most excited to see submissions on?
Yeah, it is a lot of ground. I have worked for years in my own career quite a bit in cell and gene therapies and advanced therapeutics and rare disease. So I'm always interested to see what's next and what is impactful and cutting edge in that space. I'm also really excited to see what work we can showcase in new standards for reproducibility and reporting and open data or code for model-informed drug development, which is really advanced and been formalized in a lot of ways in the past years, but there's still a lot of work to be done there.
What types of papers are you hoping to receive for this issue? Original research is particularly encouraged, but what about reviews, position papers, or tutorial-style submissions?
Yeah, I think we're open to all article types in this issue, and the call for papers does have a little bit of specificity about what might be nice if someone is interested in submitting something on one of these topics. I think that all of these formats bring value, right? Original research and perspectives and state-of-the-art or review, these are all useful sort of in different ways. So it's a very open field in this call for papers in that way.
That's good to know. The call specifically invites case studies on implementing ICH M15 guidelines across different contexts of use, things like dose selection, population selection, pivotal trial design, and labeling using modeling methodologies like PBPK, QSP, exposure response, and AIML. In your experience, where does translating M15 principles from guidance into an actual submission tend to break down in practice?
Well, this is a really active topic in the field and also in my own personal professional work. This really, I think, gets to the heart of the fact that we have these sort of overlapping but distinct quantitative disciplines, and none of whom actually, quote unquote, own MIDD, model-informed drug development, the guidance doesn't list any, you know, statisticians only or clinical pharmacologists only. So harmonizing all of these different standards and terminologies and histories and best practices for a regulatory presentation, but also even for internal decision-making at a sponsor is quite challenging in practice, right? There's a lot of sort of lost in translation things that can happen. And I think that structured working groups between statistics, clinical pharmacology, pharmacometrics, and maybe other disciplines, regulatory affairs, or certainly clinicians, is really essential to this recent guidance to make it successful and to make sure that we're all speaking the same language there.
Okay, thank you. Real-world evidence and causal inference come up together in the call. Real-world evidence is notoriously vulnerable to confounding and bias. What would a causal inference method need to demonstrate in terms of design, diagnostics, and sensitivity analysis before you'd trust it to support a regulatory decision?
Yeah, so that is a great question that I think is to some degree unsolved. And I hope that some of the authors who submit to this special issue can actually tackle that exact question. So there's very subtle issues in interpretation and biases that can arise in this field. But at the same time, the ability to get really impactful medical and public health insights has clearly been demonstrated with real-world evidence methodologies and work. So I think in general terms, these applications need rigorous control of confounding by indication and other types of biases, immortal time bias, or other structural issues. But it should also ideally show a range of plausible values under a range of modeling assumptions and assumptions about the data to ensure that what we're seeing is not a fluke signal or it's not an artifact of some type of confounding. So the working practice of these methods is a topic we really hope that we can get some traction and insight on for this issue, because it's a big topic.
Thank you. The call also highlights uncertainty, quantification, and regulatory acceptable validation for AI, ML, and hybrid mechanistic or data-driven models. Is there anything close to an agreed-upon standard for what makes a hybrid model regulatory acceptable right now, or is that still being worked out case by case?
Yeah, there's probably not a standard, a hard standard. I would say that we're not at a place where there's like just a universal checklist for machine learning or hybrid models that makes it regulatory acceptable. And it's still very much context dependent, but it is also, you know, not a blank slate anymore. The direction, I think, from regulators is pretty clear. They're asking questions very similar to some of the MIDD questions. You know, what is the context of use? What decision will this model inform, and how much influence does this model have on the decision, and what's the consequences if maybe the model gets it wrong? And is the validation proportionate to the level of decision and risk associated with that? So again, very consistent with ICHM-15. FDA's AI draft guidance also emphasizes a risk-based credibility assessment for specific contexts of use rather than sort of just declaring blanket that a model is valid in all settings. So my answer again is no, there's not a single agreed standard in the sense of checkbox ABC or do these five things and the model is acceptable. But there is certainly an emerging regulatory logic around that. And the model has to be fit for purpose and credible for the decision it's going to support. And certainly, this is a big issue, transparent enough that reviewers and regulators can understand its strengths and its limitations.
Has anyone published anything on this regulatory logic or anything like that? I mean, are there any papers that could guide people, or is that something that maybe would be good for this issue?
I think it would be good for this issue. This is certainly a hot topic, right? So there could be some commentaries out there that I'm sure there are commentaries out there that I'm unaware of. But for the clinical pharmacology audience, for the audience of our publication, ASCPT journal family, I think that there's a need for more of this specificity.
Well, if someone listening would like to submit that, we would appreciate it. Federated learning and privacy-aware methods are listed as a topic of interest in the call for integrating pharmacologic and real-world data without centralizing it. What do you see as the biggest analytical trade-off when you can't pool the raw data directly?
Federated learning is definitely attractive because it allows for institutions or settings to contribute evidence without necessarily moving patient-level data into a central repository. And that can be like really valuable for rare diseases, in particular, multi-site PK/PD analyses. But analytically, really the hardest part is that you might not be able to interrogate the raw data as an analyst as freely. You might not be able to see the full distribution or outliers or missingness patterns or, you know, site-specific sort of coding differences, how things are coded, in the same way that you might with individual level data. And in clinical pharmacology, those details can be quite important. So you need much more discipline around analyzing data in this setting. And you have to be careful about heterogeneity. A federated model could give you a pooled answer, but the scientific question could be additional on specific sites or populations or treatment patterns or clinical contexts or outcomes. So I see federated learning as kind of an evidence integration strategy. It can be powerful, but has to have the infrastructure around data quality and diagnostics and interpretation that are quite strong.
Thank you. The call also mentions integrating new approach methodologies and a plausible mechanism pathway into model-informed drug development and regulatory decision-making. Can you help our listeners understand how a plausible mechanism pathway actually functions as a decision framework and how it sits alongside more traditional evidence hierarchies?
Yeah, well, this is sort of new guidance, so I think that we're all still learning about this. It's very interesting, this plausible mechanism pathway. So I think about this as sort of a evidentiary argument, right? Like we tend to privilege, and definitely for good reason, randomized clinical trials as people always call it the gold standard of research, but in some settings, rare diseases or with advanced therapies or any kind of situation where a conventional trial is sort of more difficult, the question becomes, okay, can we assemble a coherent chain of evidence, a totality of evidence that makes the therapeutic rationale like credible, right? And that is very hard in some settings, especially for rare diseases or for advanced therapeutics. So a plausible mechanism pathway, again, really asks whether all of this evidence, the biology and the biomarkers, the pharmacology, the early clinical data, all sort of point in the right direction in the context of usually a well-understood pathophysiology. So in that sense, it sits alongside model-informed drug development pretty naturally. And new approach methodologies, NAMs, can really provide the human relevant experimental evidence along with PBPK and exposure response and other things, and really connect that evidence to dosing and pharmacodynamics and safety. And clinical and biomarker data can then test whether the expected biological effect is actually appearing in patients as we might expect from a situation that fits this plausible mechanism pathways. So the NAMS draft guidance frames NAMS around validation and human biological relevance and context of use. The plausible mechanism framework is similarly about generating enough totality of data, non-clinical, clinical safety, to support a regulatory decision. So I would describe plausible mechanism as sort of a structured way to reason when the usual evidence path is kind of incomplete or more challenging.
Oh, that actually dovetails nicely with another mini theme that CPT is publishing very soon. We have a mini theme on NAMS coming out with the journal. And it also reminds me of a conversation I had on this podcast with Janet Woodcock and Marshall Summer earlier this year. They wrote a couple reviews for CTS where they were talking about the feasibility of trials in rare diseases and how the randomized control trial is not necessarily feasible in that setting. So I think this issue will help build on those things very nicely. Are there any last thoughts you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Yeah, I really just want to encourage anyone listening who has an idea for a research article or a perspective to not be shy about reaching out to myself or to CPT directly. We're very amenable to consultation and brainstorming, and CPT really offers great author support through you, Alana, and the entire CPT team. So very engaging journal to work with, very rigorous. So please don't be shy about contacting us.
I will echo that completely. If you have any questions, please do get in touch. We are very open to pre-submission inquiries, so you can send those to the journal staff. We'll be happy to share them with the editorial team, which can sometimes save you the trouble of submitting an entire paper just to be told it might be out of scope. So please do feel free to reach out to us. Avery, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It's been a really great conversation. No one will know this was your first podcast, I promise. You were fantastic. So
Oh, that's great.
this call for papers is available on the ASCBT website, and we'll also include a link in the description of this episode. All submissions are due by October 31st, 2026. So if you have any questions about manuscript types or submitting to CPT, please feel free to contact Managing Editor Alethea Girding at alethea@ascpt.org. That's alethea@ascpt.org. Avery, thanks again. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to ClinPharm Pod. Be sure to check out past episodes while you're here, and remember to visit ascpt.org for updated podcast releases, our latest webinars, and the most recent issue of all three journals.